and welcome everybody on this St. Patrick's Day. And we have, just so that everybody knows what we're going to do this morning, we have some administrative matters that the LFO staff is going to review with us. And then, despite the fact that in this first phase we were not generally taking public testimony, I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair. We have two people that have come from some distance. I think it's important that the public have an opportunity to weigh in the Ways and Means process, and so I'm going to invite the two folks that have signed up to testify to come forward. And then we will finish the Secretary of State's presentation. And then I want to have the opportunity at the end of the committee to, at the end of the hearing, to chat with the committee a little bit about what our assignment is for next week and how I would propose, with your concurrence, to discharge those responsibilities. So with that, Monica, if you'd walk us through.
Sure. Chair, members of the committee, yesterday you had asked a question on the Attorney General opinion on performance audits. And so before you, you have copies of two opinions, one specifically discussing performance audits, the other talking about auditing of school districts that I came across. So those copies are before you. There was one other question that you had concerning whether notary fees covered the full cost of that service, and the agency has affirmed that, yes, in fact, they do cover the full cost of that. So I think that that's all I have just for a quick administrative update.
Thank you very much. We have two witnesses that are signed up, Ruth Brendel and Sharon Cornish. And would you ladies like to testify together or separately?
Yes, okay.
Then I would invite you to come forward, please. And just to let you know how the committee is proceeding, this is, to the best of our ability, an acronym-free zone. And if you would please spell your last name for the benefit of the staff, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, it's, my name is Ruth Bendel. And it's B-E-N-D-L, and I've come from Washington County, Cedar Hills, and my address is 10980 Southwest Muirwood Drive, Portland 97225. And Sharon?
Thank you.
Yeah.
My name is Sharon Cornish. I'm from Washington County, and my address is P.O. Box 312 Hillsboro.
Thank you very much. Please begin.
Both Sharon and I went to the presentation about the centralized voter registration system last week. And I will say straight off that we were less than thrilled with what we heard. And I'll get straight to the point why. And I've got testimony that I already emailed to your offices, but I've got copies here.
Thank you very much, and you can rest assured that we will make sure that all the members of the committee
yes,
have it and it becomes
copies,
part of the
yes.
record.
The first thing that really set us back was that this system with the software and everything is designed for the fact that for proof of identification, Social Security, last four digits of Social Security number would be required from registrants, and also a driver's license copy. However, everybody that's currently in the system, rightly or wrongly, is just being merged into the system. Now, that everybody is going to be, what, 95-98% of the people that are at present going to go into the system. And none of them have been required, with the exception of the few that registered in 2003 and 2004, none of them were required to give proof of ID. And the only ones that were required, they did not, if they did not submit proof of ID, they still, thank you very much. You can tell we're not the best, thank you.
No, you're doing fine.
Those people, even if they didn't submit proof of ID, they got ballots. This is for a federal election. And the fact that they didn't provide proof of ID, the vote-by-mail manual instructed county clerks to delete that information. So here we've got a system, $10 million worth, and the data that's going into it doesn't give fulfill the mission. In short, there's no traceable data being given. Now, I'm not happy with the social security number. It doesn't prove eligibility to vote, nor does the driver's license. But at least it's a trackable piece of data so that you do know that it's the one person moving from one place to the other. And that only that one person is getting a ballot. Here you've got a system. I mean, this reminds me of the Portland water billing system or the DMV fiasco. I don't understand, even, since it was known that this system was coming online, why there was such a lax approach to the 200,000 people who registered prior to this federal election. The only ones required to give proof of ID were the ones that mailed in their registration. And if they didn't provide proof of ID, too bad, they still got their ballot counted. And then, of course, there's no record. So when I requested in four counties the numbers of people who violated what was said in Appendix 10 of the vote by mail manual, namely that this identification must be received in order to complete your registration for the next federal election. And in order for that, never mind. So we spent extra money having that Appendix 10 sent out to people who'd ignored the requirement on their voter registration card, not sent ID. Further letter sent, never mind. Their ballots shoveled into the count. And every trace of the fact that their ballots, that they had not complied, is gone. So we've got now, in Washington County, people in this category, because I went to the county commissioners and made a fuss about this, we did get the list. 4,000 people. Now that's not including all the people who registered with a canvasser and their applications were brought in by the bucket load and no check was made. No requirement for proof of ID. So I'm telling you, close to 200,000 people. We could have at least had a head start and gotten their ID. But no, we didn't, for some reason. And that even violates federal election law, because anything pertaining to federal ballots has to be kept for 2 years. When I requested from Marion County, and I've got the letter here, Steve Cragen told me, well, you know, once they had voted in the federal election, we were instructed to remove the notification from the system, so we no longer know who met requirements and who didn't. And, you know, this kind of thing really floors me, because there is no doubt, if you just look at Washington State, that there are people that are violating the integrity and the sanctity of the ballot. Voting twice, you name it. Voting in a number of counties. They had ballots from people that were dead, from felons. We have no clue. All that we've been given over the years is name, address, and a mailing address. Sharon and I went out to give out a material for Golia Mary before the election, for independence. Do you have any clue how many homes we couldn't find? This is in my neighborhood that I'm very familiar with. The streets were true, but the street numbers didn't exist. And it's easily done, because as long as the person gives a P.O. box or a mailing address of somebody else, that ballot's going to go to them, and the card acknowledging their registration will get to them. And that means that they're fine. And when I asked, you know, when you've sent out this Appendix 10, why haven't you put these people as provisional ballots and kept the record that they've not complied? The answer was from Alice in Wonderland. Well, these people, whether they complied or not, they voted in a federal election. That makes them fine. That makes them good electors. I don't get it. I feel like I've fallen down the rabbit hole in Alice in Wonderland when I get those kinds of answers. And I was getting those answers from a number of county clerks. Julie Bates in Multnomah County gave me that when I went to a presentation by the Secretary of State earlier on, an informational. The Hood River clerk was parroting this. We'll get the same people saying the same thing. If your vote-by-mail manual tells you that there is proof of ID required, then, for goodness sake, even if you give a ballot and you treat it as a provisional ballot, keep the thing in the system so that you know these people definitely need to still comply. We have different standards for people who are declared inactive because they haven't voted in 5 years. They have to update their registration. If they've moved and not updated, they don't get a ballot. They have to update their registration. So what we are saying, we have asked why everybody isn't being re-registered to make and have to supply the HAVA required ID so that the system can function and prove something. Personally, I want to have the driver's license upgraded to fulfill the true ID requirements and to show the legal status of that person. Then we know that the person is an elector, and we know that they're only voting once, and we can track everything. But at the moment, we've got a system that doesn't even come close to providing what it's intended to provide, and we're in a post-9/11 era. I'm sure you remember, back in the 80s, we had a scare with the Rajneeshis, and so we initiated the 21-day cutoff date so that checking could be done before people got to vote. There was a fear that an onslaught and everything. Well, we've had 9/11, and there are people that would like to infiltrate us, do us harm, and maybe infiltrate our government, or at least change how we vote. And I urge you to put in a mandate that we all must re-register.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Avakian.
I just wanted to sum up what you had said so that it's all clear to us as you finish up here. It sounds like you think that the integrity of the system is primarily based on looping back to having some type of valid, you even said an upgraded type of identification at the beginning, so that the data is reliable. That's correct? Okay.
Applied to everybody. You know, I just want to add one thing. If the HAVA required proof of ID, namely what they're suggesting, 4 digits of the social security number and the driver's license, isn't important enough for all the bulk of the people going into the system, why is it necessary for the straggle of people that are going to come from here on hence to have to part with that information, and they'll be the targets of identity theft? I mean, a lot of people feel uncomfortable about giving that ID. But the fact of the matter is, if it's just a minute fraction that have given that data, what do you have this huge, cumbersome system for?
Thank you. Representative Avakian, does that...
Done.
Okay.
I just want to make sure we got your main point.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bendel. Ms. Cornish?
I would just like to say that I don't want the mess that exists now to be dumped in the system to be started up with. I want everything cleaned up. I personally registered years ago, but I also observed elections for 3 weeks straight, 21 days on election night. I was there. I don't want the mess dumped in. And then start with the mess, and then, all of a sudden, require ID. There's no way. Why do we do things like this? We need proof of ID in this era. I don't even like the proof that they're going to use, and that's driver's licenses. There are so many bogus driver's licenses out there. They're not credible. And as far as the last four numbers on Social Security, I asked a question last week. Does government staff, are they required when they're hired to go through criminal check? The answer is no. I don't want Social Security numbers used by government staff or any other person that's smart enough to hack in to this system. We were also told at the last meeting that there is no great security on this system. So there you go.
Thank you very much for making the effort to come down and share this information with the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for making the exception for us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Secretary, I invite you and your staff to come back up, and we'll continue on with your presentation. Monica, while they're getting settled, if you would just refresh the committee where we left off yesterday.
Okay. Chair and members of the committee, we were reviewing their department-wide priorities, which should be behind your Appendix C tab. And I believe we were about line 22. I think we were discussing HAVA when we were.
Thank you.
So how apropos.
That is fortuitous, serendipitous and fortuitous. And what I might just, given my revelation last night, share with the committee, any detailed questions that you would like to request of the staff or the secretary with respect to these prioritizations, this is the appropriate time to delve a little deeper if you're not satisfied with the explanation, because we will be using this format with your concurrence to work the prioritizations next week. So if, as the secretary and his staff move through this line item by line item, I invite your deeper questions in order to facilitate the prioritization for next week. So, Mr. Secretary, let's move in with HAVA.
Okay. For the record, Madam Chair, Patty McGuire, Deputy Secretary of State, and with your indulgence, I'll just continue to march through our priorities. Interestingly enough, the next priority on our list is Help America Vote Act implementation, and specifically the centralized voter registration system. I want to make two corrections to our form here on line 22. The general fund number should be zero, not $314,000. And there are three FTE associated with this, and I'm not quite sure what happened there, but that's the correct number. The $700,000 in the above line will give us the matching funds to perform both of these functions.
I'm sorry, Mr. McGuire, where are you?
I'm in the department-wide priorities, line 22. Agency priority number 22. ISD, Help America Vote Act. You with me?
Yep.
Okay.
What was the number again, though? I'm sorry.
General fund is zero. Okay. FTE is three. And those are limited duration positions. Okay. Just a word, since I sort of don't want to get off into the policy discussion too far of the centralized voter registration system, but just a word of response to Ms. Bendel and Ms. Shepard. I believe their quarrel is not with our implementation of the law, but with the federal law itself. I mean, we are implementing the Help America Vote Act as it was written by Congress. And, you know, it is certainly within the legislature's purview to raise, change the ID requirements. It's certainly within the legislature's purview to require every Oregon voter to re-register. Those are decisions you get to make. We don't believe those are decisions we get to make. I feel pretty strongly, I believe very much that we are implementing and have implemented the Help America Vote Act as Congress wrote it. The $4 million here in federal funds, of course, this requires the $700,000 in match on the line above. This will allow us to finish the system and run it as a program. During the next biennium, we will be in the transition from project to program, and of finishing building the project, building the centralized voter registration system, and moving into running it. If I can digress for just one more time, I think this is a great success story from an economic development standpoint. We selected Sabre Consulting of Salem as the contractor to build this system, competing against Bermuda-based Accenture Corporation and Ohio-based Diebold. Since we selected Sabre, they have been selected by three more states, and we expect more news about additional states in the coming weeks. There are about 50 Oregonians who have jobs working on building centralized voter registration systems in Salem, Oregon. It is a great economic development success story, and we're very proud of that fact. We are seeing other states, the other states that are being successful in meeting the federal deadline. Many more of them are Sabre states than non-Sabre states.
Just a question. I had in my notes here that the 700,000 access is 18 million in federal funds. Where would the balance of those funds show up?
The balance of those funds, Senator, will be deposited into the election fund. This is limitation to spend down on that fund. We do not anticipate spending down $18 million in the next biennium. Part of what we are planning in terms of implementing HAVA is to maintain in the election fund several millions of dollars because part of the HAVA legislation, the election fund is created and interest stays in the election fund. We want to build a sustaining fund to help subsidize the cost of the new programs that are required. This federal money is one-time money. We'd like, when we're done implementing the one-time things that we're required to do, to leave money behind and live off the interest of that money. So it is not our intent to spend down all $18 million in the next biennium. We want to leave a legacy behind.
So that legacy will be about a $14 million fund.
I don't think it will be that much because there are significant ongoing costs of running the centralized system of about $1.5 million a year.
A year? A biennium.
A year. I don't know. I mean, we haven't decided whether in 07 we're going to be back for $3 million in general fund money to run that system, or whether we'll spend down the remaining balance. That decision hasn't been made. But, I mean, it is our intent at the end of the day to stretch out the life of this money as long as we can.
Representative Smith.
Good seeing you.
Good seeing you.
Would it be possible to get kind of a projected budget on how you see those dollars being spent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we have a projected budget. I mean, it is sort of I mean, it is rough. I will confess it's rough. We have, and I'd be happy to supply that to you over the next 4 years.
I think it's important. You know, that's a lot of money in this building.
Absolutely.
Right now, and
absolutely.
Just to see how, you know, what the plan of attack is.
And the message we want to give is that this limitation gets us through the base HAVA programs. Anything else that we want to do, any other expenditures we want to do, we're going to have to come back either through the Ways and Means process or the e-board process, because this is limitation. So
I don't think it, yeah, my questions aren't directed with malice. It's more, I'm just curious how they're, plan is.
You know, I think one of the things we have thought about, and there's considerable interest in among the county clerks, is replacing old counting equipment in counties. You know, that becomes a policy choice as to whether something that has traditionally been a county responsibility, buying elections equipment, should become a state/federal responsibility. There is certainly a public policy argument to be made that new equipment works better than old equipment. New equipment counts ballots more efficiently, more effectively than old equipment. New equipment can count optical scan ballots no matter whether you use number two pencil or ink. Old equipment mostly can only count number two pencils. That's something we're very interested in. There in our long range budget, you will see that there's a pot of money for replacement of county equipment. But again, it will be through the e-board process or the Ways and Means process. We haven't made final decisions on that just because we don't have the $18 million, so we sort of haven't decided how to spend it all until it gets here.
So as soon as, if we could just see a cash flow on that. And
absolutely.
How you see it. Thank you.
Moving on, number 23, Administrative Rules, the Archives Division, publishes the administrative rules promulgated by the rest of state government. Number 24 is the State Record Center. This is a fee-based program for state agencies to provide low-cost long-term storage of records. There's a building that in North Salem, in the industrial district in North Salem, where there are a big old warehouse full of thousands and thousands of boxes, this is a much more efficient way for agencies to store records than in their basement or other places. 25, municipal audits. The statute requires that that municipalities file annual audits, financial audits, with the audits division. We have two people who do spot reviews of audits, work with but for the most part, those are contracted out by the local communities. As the government auditing standards have changed, we've spent a great deal of time in the last couple of years working with auditors around Oregon on the changing federal standards and how to write effective audits in a changing world in which the auditing standards are a lot more complicated. Number 26, K-12 auditing. When Secretary Bradbury was running for re-election last year, this was sort of one of the things he talked about the most during the campaign, was expanding our audit function to include K-12 school districts. Currently, we believe we have the constitutional authority to conduct audits of K-12 schools. This is a funding mechanism. We will be changing this POP from $1.3 million to $500,000 for the biennium, and from 10 FTE to 4. This is connected to Senate Bill 155, which is currently in the General Government Committee, and I think is being heard next week. Yes. And they, and under the current statute, if we were to conduct, say, an audit of the Salem-Keizer School District, we would do the audit, and we could do the audit, and then we would send them a bill for our services, which seems like a little bit of salt in the wound. And so we have, there hasn't been an audit like that since an audit in the early 90s, I believe, of the Klamath Union School District.
Question from Representative Smith.
Thank you, Senator Morse. We're talking financial audit?
No.
Tell me, what type of audit are we talking about?
We are talking performance audits. Currently, school districts do, as part of the municipal audit function, currently school districts do financial audits of their programs. The idea here is to do performance audits of school districts.
How does that differ, follow up if I may, how does that differ between the oversight functions of the Department of Education and the auditing that they're capable of doing with our schools?
I am not completely familiar with DOE's oversight role, and so I can't really speak to that. We've in discussions about this, we've been in contact regularly with the superintendent's office, and they are supportive of our efforts in this regard. So I will make the leap that this is not overlapping with that, but I can't speak with any specificity about that, but I can sure find out.
Yeah, would you mind before round two, if there's a communication between you folks and Department of Education? Because I may be way off base. I just want to find out what function you serve that they don't, and vice versa.
Be happy to.
Just as a follow-up question to this, what would be the source of the funds for this auditing?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, the idea is that this would come out of basic school support, $500,000 basically off the top of basic school support. And so the principle being to share to fund K-12 auditing in essentially the way we fund the rest of the audits division. The rest of the audits division is an assessment across state government. Everybody pays a little. This would be the same principle. All school districts would pay a little, in a sense.
Forgive me for jumping into this conversation. With respect to the audits, they'd all be conducted in exactly the same format? Would the same team go? Talk a little bit about the details. I mean, $500,000 out of the basic school support is a chunk of change. And I'm just trying to get a sense of, do you have the work plan scoped for how this audit would occur, or audits would occur?
Well, our chief auditor, Kathy Polino, has developed a work program. It includes four additional performance auditors, and basically the proposal is to do some audits based on requests from school districts, and then to do some what I call cross-cutting audits, which are audits that look at several school districts and how they're handling data processing, or several school districts and looking at how they're handling transportation, so that you can find some better systems that can be offered to all of the school districts from those kinds of comprehensive, those cross-cutting audits.
Thank you. That's helpful. I'm trying to assimilate and understand with all the folks that are looking at school performance. You've got the chalkboard project funded at a jaw-dropping amount by the private foundations that have stepped forward in that exercise. You've got an initiative currently underway by OBC. I had asked in another setting that there be a matrix developed and shared with the legislature about all the reviews that are occurring in K-12. Talk about what value added this exercise would bring.
Well, let's back up a notch and look at the track record for performance audits of state government. Okay, for every dollar we spend on performance audits, we identify $8 in potential savings. There's no reason to believe that a similar kind of saving couldn't be found at school districts.
Can I interrupt you, Mr. Secretary?
Of course you
can. Just a second. We study this area to death. What I'm interested in getting on the record here is, how would you propose implementing any findings that you have? Let's assume, for example, and I'm giving you just one that I know off the top of my head, we spend $134 million a year transporting students to and from school. What if your audit showed up that that was not a cost-efficient expenditure? Talk about when the audit's done and the findings are in, how you intend to get on-the-ground implementation of any of your management recommendations.
It would be very similar to the way we get on-the-ground implementation of our audits of state agencies. We do not have regulatory authority over state agencies. We are the auditor. And 80% of the recommendations that we have made have, in fact, been implemented by various state agencies. I would assume the same approach in school districts. Most state agencies find our audits to be useful roadmaps for them to move in a more efficient operating direction. Schools, one would assume, would take the same approach, because if we can find ways for them to run more efficiently, it means that the dollars they get, more of them can be put in the classroom, which is obviously their first priority. So my assumption is that if we provide these services to schools, they make use of them and find benefit from it.
Do you have a record of any school districts that have come forward and asked for such an audit?
Well, no. I mean, I don't have any audit. I don't have any record of that right now, because we haven't been offering it to schools.
Thank you,
Chair.
Representative Avakian.
Along the same lines, looking both to the Constitution and to the Attorney General's opinion, which is very helpful, it looks as if your duties extend to auditing state money.
Right.
Which would, I guess, mean that you don't, for instance, audit Title I federal money, nor property tax money, local property tax money. That's out, too. And that also the other parameter seems to be this definition of your duty, that you're to determine that the state funds are legally expended, meaning expended for the purpose of which they are appropriated, consistent with any legal restrictions on the use of the funds. Is that a fair definition of the type of audit that you do?
Basically, it's a performance audit is slightly broader, but it comes under the Attorney General's interpretation of our auditing authority.
And then, I'm sorry, Madam
Chair. Follow up, Mr. Representative.
Thank you. It also looks that you are the, by law, the exclusive auditor. Is that right? Is that how you would interpret it? So that school districts, even if they chose to, maybe couldn't validly perform their own audit, that function lies with you.
Madam Chair, Representative Lockheed, I believe the Attorney General's opinion about exclusivity extends to state government, not to subdivisions of state government, in that there are a number of counties have elected county auditors, and that's not a question I've ever thought about, but I think that's the intent.
And one other, the other thing that obviously has changed dramatically in the last 12 years is the amount of state money that's going to schools. It used to be about a third came from the state. It's now two-thirds that comes from the state. And if the reason we have legislation is partly to sort of pay for it overall rather than billing individual school districts, but also because it's real complicated when you're auditing a school to try to define which is general fund or which is basic school support and which is property tax. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous. So we need the legislation to be clearly able to just audit schools, not just the general fund that's coming to schools.
Correct. May I have one more?
Follow.
And part of what I was leading to with this is also increasing is the amount of federal money coming in. We're close to $600 million in federal money. And, you know, and that seems to be on the rise rather than the decline. So I'm wondering who then is in charge of auditing the federal money. Is there a federal process that's at work in Oregon that takes care of that, or do we know?
Madam Chair, Representative Vakian, we do, the federal government delegates to the states responsibility for doing a financial audit of all federal funds, and our audits division does that, and that's in priority number one. And so I believe that extends to auditing of federal funds going to political subdivisions. So there would be a financial audit to ensure that those funds are spent appropriately, and this would extend that to be a look that those funds were being spent efficiently.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. I can have a macro question here. Of your FTE, how many of those are contractors? How many people do you contract with?
In FTE in our budget, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, are all employees.
Folks don't have any, no contractors.
We do contract out quite a bit of our audit function. Those that does not that shows up as dollars, not as FTE.
Is that responsive, Representative Smith?
Look, I don't mean to digress, but can we go back to number one, financial audits, where we show total funds of $6,044,000 with 30 FTE. Are any of those contractor positions?
None of those are contractor positions, because contractors would not show up as FTE. That there is contracting dollars in this. There are contracting dollars in the $6 million, but those don't show up as FTE.
The reason I'm asking that question, when I look at number one and I do very elementary math and I take 30 divided by 20 divided by 2, it comes out to $100,745 per year for FTE. But then I go down to number three under performance audits, and I do the same calculation, and it's $80,630. And so I'm trying to figure out, you know, I'm assuming a financial auditor and a performance auditor are different, but professionally, you know, pretty even. I'm trying to figure out why a difference of $20,000 based on that elementary math. What's being spent up in financial audits that's not being spent down in?
My assumption would be that more contracts are let for financial audits. So it's not, in other words, you have 30 FTE, but you have a lot more money than just supporting the 30 FTE being spent on financial audits through contracts.
So walk me through the contracts. Who would we contract with and why?
Representative Smith, quite a bit of the financial audit work is contracted out. A lot of that is because of the cyclical nature of that work. That the federal, we have a relatively short period of time to complete the federal audit work. We would have to devote all our staff and more to finishing that in the time frame that we have, so we contract out a significant portion of that. Those are bids let across the state, private accounting firms.
So of the $6 million, how much goes to FTE and how much goes to contracts?
I'm going to have to get back to you. I don't know the numbers, but we can. I don't have that at my fingertips, but I can sure get that to you very shortly.
Very quick.
Okay. Thank you.
And just to make the distinction with performance audits, it has been our experience that we are much more successful at contracting financial audit work than performance audit work. There just aren't that many people in the private sector who are able to do performance audits of government agencies very well. We just haven't had a lot of great experiences with that, and so we have found
it's
better to hire and train people to do that and focus our personnel attention on the performance side and contract out more of the financial side.
Well, if you could just send me a quick memo just kind of explaining that.
Yeah, done.
Thank you. And what we have done in the past, as you know, Mr. McGuire, is ask you to send it through the professional staff, and they'll disseminate the information to the entire panel. Before you continue, we have been joined up here at the dais by Brooke Kohlberg. Is that correct, Brooke? Brooke is Senator Morris's job shadow for today. And, Brooke, just so that you know what we're hearing right now, this is the Secretary of State's budget for the state of Oregon. And this gentleman at the end of the table is the Secretary of State. He's a statewide elected official for the state of Oregon, Bill Bradbury.
Hi.
And so you're hearing one of the very important budgets that relates to the office that handles all of the elections in the state of Oregon, takes care of our archives, does a number of functions, and you'll hear them described as we move through the testimony this morning. But we welcome you. Where are you from?
I'm from Gilkey Middle School.
Very good. Well, we welcome you to the panel this morning, and we'll ask the Secretary and his staff to please continue.
So now we have to be on our best behavior.
That's absolutely
all of us. And I'm
thank you, Madam Chair, for the courtesies extended. That's appreciated.
Mr. Secretary, please continue.
Madam Chair, next is priority number 27, the Oregon Blue Book. This is a semi-annual publication, and I see you have one of the hot-off-the-press 05-07 Blue Books.
Amazing pictures.
Isn't that a fabulous
picture?
Isn't
that a great picture?
Interestingly enough, the picture is entitled 4th of July Fireworks, but I believe that's the Rose Festival. it's artistic license. We didn't name the photograph.
You know, Mr. McGuire, you have just blown an excellent public relations because all of us would have claimed that for some spectacular city in our own district, and you have just now put the lie to that. And
I don't think Scappoose has buildings.
I don't.
You haven't been there.
The story of the Blue Book, I think more than anything, is the expansion of it as an online publication, and we're very, very proud of the work that's been done and the usage that the online Blue Book gets in addition to the traditional model.
Mr. McGuire, I'm going to interrupt you one more time before you go ahead. I think we've been joined by another job shadow today, and I'm going to ask Representative Avakian to introduce his guest and job shadow.
Stephen, what's your last name?
London.
This is Stephen London, also from Gilkey, and job shadowing me today. It's nice to have you, Stephen.
We're very pleased to welcome you to the panel. We are in the process of hearing one of the important budgets of the state of Oregon. This gentleman at the end of the table is the Secretary of State. He's a statewide elected official, and this is a very important agency and budget that handles all of the elections in the state, and the Secretary of State and his staff are just in the process of describing the work that they do with respect to publishing the Oregon Blue Book, which is right there in front of you. I'm sure you've seen that publication. Good. Well, welcome to our panel. Mr. Secretary, would you continue?
Madam Chair, moving on, if there are no more questions about the Blue Book, priority number 28 is information technology audits. This is an expanding area within our audits division, though this is not, in fact, an expansion, but it is something that we have devoted more and more effort to looking at information technology systems around the state, security, all those sorts of things, it has been a quite fruitful area, and I think you can hear from state agencies that have been audited by our IT auditors that we've brought a lot of value to the table.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had an issue that came before our interim committee on cybersecurity and deficiencies. How are you interfacing with DAS and the appropriations that we made out of the emergency fund to upgrade and correct the cybersecurity breaches that we have in our system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, this is less about the core technical side of IT security than the sort of human side. This is looking at systems and processes and the way looking for things like passwords on sticky notes stuck on computer terminals, which is a surprisingly common finding out there in the world. These auditors are not highly skilled technical people. That not the true propeller heads, these are.
For those of us that spend a lot of time in the helicopter,
take considerable
umbrage at that characterization. Please continue.
These are people who are trained in looking at systems and how people interact with those systems. If that distinction makes any sense.
Is that responsive, Senator Morrison?
Mr.
McGuire, before you continue, I'd like to go back to priority number 30, the voters' pamphlet, and then call your attention to 37. In the policy option package for the fees. And my question is, if we end up with a fee-based voters pamphlet, can we find savings for the $100,000 in line 30?
Madam Chair, the split here between 30 and 37 and 38 is the 30 is the FTE associated with the voters pamphlet. This is a piece of one of the elections division employees who spends a portion of an election cycle on working on the voters pamphlet. And so we thought that given the discussion earlier about our ability to sort of pull the elections division apart, I mean, obviously you don't need a person working through the biennium on the voters pamphlet because it is incredibly seasonal work. And so because of the difficulty in pulling the staff of the elections division apart, we thought the division was appropriate. So in direct answer to your question is no.
And I guess in pushing back to the direct answer to my question being no, I guess I'm not quite satisfied with the answer to prorate that portion of their work. And if we're going to a fee for service for the voters pamphlet, and I think the voters pamphlet is the best bang for the buck anywhere. I know there was quite a debate last session about the fees to cover the production costs. I simply don't understand from your explanation why you couldn't prorate that piece of those FTEs work and absorb the $100,000 into being covered for fees or with fees.
Madam Chair, after consultation, I want to amend my answer. I will change my answer to that depends.
We're moving incrementally in the right direction, Mr. McGuire. We might make it to yes in the next hour.
It depends entirely on the level of fees. The bill, Senate Bill 163 that is currently in the Senate Rules Committee, which is the fee bill that came out of the Senate. Passed the Senate? Did it? I can't remember whether it got out of Senate rule. It did pass the Senate.
Yes.
Last session, the Senate, our original bill raised the fees on both the general and primary elections. The Rules Committee, in their wisdom, kept our higher fees in the general election and lowered the fees in the primary election, meaning that the fees would not be enough to fully cover the cost. I mean, that's If you want to raise the fees to cover all of the cost of the voter's pamphlet, that's certainly a legislative decision that we would support.
Right.
So I guess I would say that's up to you.
Representative Smith.
I want to wait till you get to your yes answer.
We're moving there. We're getting there.
just a quick question. The manufacturing of the pamphlet, is that contracted out?
The actual printing, yes. Through the state printing, you know, all printing contracts go through the state printing office.
What about the production, you know, the layout of it? Who does that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, that's a split of the FTE you see here and some. We do hire contractors. Sorry, when I say here, I mean in Priority 30. Sure. I realize you can't see where I'm pointing.
Okay. I only see one FTE, though.
It is actually a third of an FTE. It's one position, a third of an FTE. We contract for additional proofreaders to come in for that because the time period is so compressed. The contractors don't show up as FTE.
How come you couldn't just contract that out? I mean, and put it out to a bid and say, you know, we've certified these statements. Now you company, here's the stack. Put it together.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith.
Am I missing something? Tell me what I'm missing here.
I think my concern would be there are so many legal requirements in doing this correctly, and the risk is so high, and we have fabulous personnel who've been doing this for years and years and years that we've made the decision to do it internally.
You know what you're doing, and it works.
Yeah, it gets done. It gets done on time. There are, thankfully, few mistakes. Frankly, when mistakes happen, I want to be responsible for them and not say, gee, it's not our fault. You know, we contracted out. I think this is it's sort of the most public thing that our agency does for common citizens. I think we need to be held accountable that it's done well and done right.
Fair answer.
Are we at 31? Okay, thank you. We maintain a call center at the Oregon State Correctional Institute to answer the phones with questions about issues related to the corporation starting a business, getting information. This is a very efficient way for us to have human beings answer the phone rather than a computer answering the phone. I will tell you, as the secretary travels around the state, and I go places, we often hear from people who say, and listed in phone books around the state, if the number for the secretary of state is this call center. And people tell us all the time that, you know, boy, I called the office and talked to that Mark, and he couldn't have been more helpful, and you know, next time you see Mark, you tell him he's doing a great job. And you know, we have to explain that Mark's desk isn't real close to mine, but we sure appreciate that they're happy. We did an experiment this last cycle to expand the call center. There are some Help America Vote Act requirements for voter information over a toll free phone line. That was very successful. We had four full-time and at peak times about 10 people out there trained to answer voter inquiries. You know, everything from where's my nearest Dropbox, what we did in terms of training was tell the inmates that you don't get to ask where their address is. You get to ask what's the intersection closest to your house or where you are. For the obvious security concerns there.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I truly want to compliment you, Secretary of State, and your staff for this because I have a lot of businesses I work with that work with and utilize this system, and it works very well. I want to jump up just with one other thing.
Follow
up on this.
up above under in your in the section where you do the business guide. I also want to thoroughly compliment you folks on that. I'm trying to find out where that was. I lost it. Let me see here. There's a comment I want to make.
Business registry.
Yeah. There it is under
13.
Yeah. Again, I want to compliment you. The product you put out, the Oregon Business Guide, is top notch. It's excellent.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to throw a little bit of extra work your way. one of the things this committee and also the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development has been advocating is trying to get down to a more elementary level for small business owners. And one of the biggest issues is a small business owner who's looking at hiring their very first employee has no clue how to do payroll. And right now you have to go to 7 different places in the state of Oregon to figure it out. Yet a lot of folks come to you folks first because of that business guide. Is there a way with legislative help to help you coordinate somehow online an effort to where an entrepreneur who had an issue could work with you folks to say, I'm ready to hire that first employee. I'm ready to do number one. Get the first one done, and that's always the most difficult employee. Is there a way to work with you folks to help them walk through that process? Because they're coming to you first for the assumed business name. They're coming to you first for, you know, if they're going to register in the state of Oregon. Now how do we take them to the next step?
I think that the interest you have in seeing that we provide some kind of service or help to small businesses in terms of their first employee relates very directly to what we're trying to do with a one-stop shop to get started.
Right.
I mean, it would be a very logical extension. It's not currently included in what we're doing with the one-stop shop, but we want to create a site online where all the different agencies, there are a lot of different agencies you got to be in touch with when you start your business.
That's right.
And we want to have a site where you can just fill out a form once online and it gets sent to all the appropriate agencies. And it would be a very logical extension of that to do what you were talking about in terms of helping with payroll.
Follow-up Representative Smith.
That's excellent. On this committee, four of us serve on the Ways and Means Economic Development Sub, and I think what we'd like to do is invite you folks to that subcommittee to talk about making that linkage and trying to figure out how to help you do that.
Right.
I'm absolutely convinced that's a pivotal thing this body can do to help the economy of the state of Oregon. So I would really, really like to work with you folks on that.
We really welcome that opportunity, and we bring some of the people from the Corporations Division who are very involved in the specific manipulations to make it all work.
It could be a great partnership between the legislature and the Secretary of State.
Right. Great.
As a follow-up, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, when we get to Priority 35, that's exactly what that is. And we have a performance measure in the back related to exactly that, which is based on the number of agencies cooperating.
Okay.
So, item 30, where am I? I've lost my place. 32. This is a POP to expand the fraud investigative capacity of the Audits Division. We've been doing some really interesting work in data mining, of looking at state databases and with sophisticated computer programs to find interesting anomalies. I mean, looking, for example, at state employees' use of state-issued credit cards. And when you do that in a broad systematic way, things tend to pop out. I mean, $1,500 charges at Best Buy, you know, it could be legitimate. You know, it might not be. And what we want is the ability to dig into those. And this is partly in response to what the Secretary was talking about yesterday in terms of with the additional requirements under the Government Accounting Standards Board for that have shifted the balance of to the financial accounting side from a third of our activity on the financial accounting side and two-thirds on the performance and fraud side to two-thirds financial and one-third fraud, we have lost capacity to follow up on things like that. We've also significantly expanded the waste, fraud, and abuse hotline. It's now answered by a real-life human person instead of a phone message machine, and we've significantly updated the fraud reporting website, fraud.oregon.gov. takes you to a very cool website that allows you in a confidential way to report fraud and a way to, and when you report fraud, it gives you a key and you can go back and find out what's happening with what you've reported, and if the investigator has follow-up questions, there's the ability for a confidential exchange of information. And I mean, we're very excited about this capacity, but need bodies to be able to follow up on all we are finding.
We're rapidly running out of time, and now I'm going to eat some of it up just with a question. I ran a state agency for 5 years. I thought it was my responsibility to be looking at my own accounts to make sure that there wasn't the $1,500 charge in Cabo San Lucas.
Right.
I'm not sure why it is within the purview of the Secretary of State's office to be doing a level of management review that ought to appropriately be happening at the agencies.
Madam Chair, absolutely, it should happen first at the agency. Our job is to be checking to see that it is happening, okay, and to make sure that fraud isn't happening. I mean, that's our job. It's not to manage the agency. It's to oversee and see that things don't happen that aren't supposed to.
Representative Smith,
convince me that you can keep the partisanship out of it.
Partisanship out of fraud.
Representative Smith, I just said we're running out of time.
what I'm curious about is you know, a lot of this is getting moved on, but you're also going to be have the ability to look into elected officials, I assume, with this fraud investigation. How do you take a legitimate investigation versus a complaint, a partisan complaint?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think that, you know, the sort of the first blush thing that auditors do is sort of look at whether there is an axe to grind here, and in sort of the first blush legitimacy test,
right.
You know, and very often, I mean, we get a lot of complaints about municipalities. This power at this point does not extend. We do not investigate municipalities, and whether the school board. I mean, we don't do that now. So, and this is our investigative powers here are limited to state government. So, you know, really, the number of elected officials involved are, I guess, the governor, the attorney general. I mean, it's a significantly smaller. I guess there could be a complaint, though I don't know that there's ever been one against a member of the assembly, that you were stealing office paper or something. But
how do you keep me from calling you up and saying Senator Johnson's a dirty dog, and launching an unnoteworthy allegation? How do you keep her from being front page of the headlines as a fraud investigation underway against Senator Johnson? I called him confidentially and said, she's a dirty dog. I know this, this, and this. How do you protect her when I'm making it all up?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I believe there is these investigations are confidential until they are completed. So if a reporter was to call and say, is there an investigation of Senator Johnson underway, we would say we can't tell you. I mean, that would not preclude you from issuing a press release saying that you filed a complaint, in, you know, which clearly happens in terms of Elections Division investigations on a fairly routine basis.
My hands are sweating, and so I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair.
I would like to talk to you, though, about that, because I think that's an issue this body is concerned about.
And just on the broader, and not to digress too far, but there is a very clear distinction that between our office and Kathy Polino, the state auditor, and we work very hard to draw a line down the middle of Court Street, because she's across the street in the Public Services Building, on decisions that are clearly hers and decisions that we are involved in. And
well, we got to move on, but I am open to being convinced, but I do want to have a conversation on
that. Thank you. And during this break, I'm going to introduce Philip Eichhorn, who is my job shadow today. Philip, tell us where you were in school. Very good. Well, welcome to our panel this morning. Okay, please continue.
Next item up, we're in a little fraud section here. Number 33, elections fraud investigation. This is a pop that would give us a full-time investigator and to work on primarily on initiative fraud. I mean, it has been a source of frustration, particularly through the last cycle. It is a source of frustration to me how long it takes to complete investigations, I mean, particularly when there is criminality alleged. And in criminal investigations, it is quite costly for us because we contract all of that to the Department of Justice and end up paying $97 or $98 an hour for their investigative work. We think we could complete a lot of that investigative work internally at significantly lower cost.
Representative Smith.
Would this include review of contribution and expenditure reports?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, potentially it could. That is not our emphasis. I mean, this what we are most interested in, and what we believe is the biggest problem, is initiative fraud, and I think sort of the new category, voter registration fraud, that there were a lot of allegations about during the last election cycle.
Please continue.
The next item is 34, legislatively requested audits. This is something we've been in consultation with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee about. We would like to have dedicated staff that is working on things that you care about. There are a lot of requests that we get from individual legislators and from the Joint Legislative Audit Committee that we aren't able to do, given the shift that we've talked about several times. And so this is to hire dedicated staff that works for us. I mean, I want to be clear that these are not legislative auditors, but that this would be dedicated staff that would work on things that the Joint Legislative Audit Committee directs us to go work on.
I'm trying to find out where the sideboards are on that. You don't want 90 requests from 90 folks in this building coming in sort of willy-nilly. I'd like to know, is the Joint Legislative Audit Committee the gatekeeper to proceed with individual legislator requests, or how do we keep this from just running absolutely amok?
I think it's fair to say that right now we tried very hard to use the Joint Legislative Audit Committee as a filter to boil down the requests, and then they're forwarded to the Audits Division. And we would hope that would continue, because we want some legislative prioritization to take place in terms of which issue should get attention first.
And that is the statutory charge of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. And there have been discussions about making the JLAC a permanent
acronym-free zone.
Sorry,
Mr. McGuire.
I said it twice all the way through.
I must have been out of the room.
And so, I mean, we believe it would be in everybody's best interest if the Joint Legislative Audit Committee could be a permanent committee that met during session two. Because last cycle, it was really only a one-year committee by the time appointments got made, and they really didn't meet, I think, until late December. So, anyway, moving on.
I have a question.
Representative Smith.
How do you keep the politics out of the audits? I mean, an audit is supposed to be an independent analysis of what's going on, and so if this becomes a permanent part of the legislature, and then we also have this as a tool. What I'm worried about is making sure that what is being performed when we say audit is done in a very systematic and unbiased, nonpartisan way. I mean, that's what an audit should be.
Right.
I mean, we know the policy. That side, but audit should be that way.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we currently get a lot of legislative requests and statutory direction to do audits. The change of director audit is an example. There was an audit ordered by the 01 session of the Safe Corporation and their actuarial tables. Those were legislative directions to us. Whether there were politics involved in enacting those laws, well, probably.
But how do you keep someone who's in a chair of that position who has a bone to pick with some? What's the filter to make sure when we use, maybe the word shouldn't be audit, but when we use the word audit, how do we make sure there's a filter in there to make sure it's an unbiased opinion? You and I can have this conversation again.
Okay.
Come visit me.
Okay.
After that. I don't want to take the chairs.
I also am going to ask the professional staff to flag this for the phase two when we start talking in more depth about prioritization. I think it's a legitimate question. I also think it's a coordination question.
Yeah.
To the degree that we had GSP, we had the government standards and practices sitting here before us telling us that they were so overwhelmed by work that they were doing around State Accident Insurance Fund, that they ended up putting other legitimate complaints off to the side, and they received no action during the time that they were completely consumed with a single investigation. So I'm using investigation now and audit, and I understand clearly the difference, but I think there's a coordination element here that we might pursue in phase two.
And Madam Chair, I'm not opposed. I just want to know how this is going to work.
I think it's a legitimate discussion. All right, it is now 10 minutes of 10, and I want to get through performance measures, the 10% cuts, and leave 15 minutes for discussion with the committee and our guests before we go.
Speed talking. Number 35 is the Central Business Registry that we discussed earlier with Representative Smith. That's funding to continue to expand it. We will have news about phase one of that, implementation of phase one of that, in a couple months. 36, Jeff Morgan's going to talk about positions.
Jeff Morgan, for the record, Director of Business Service Division. This is a pop that just adds positions in the Information Systems Division, adds three positions, a security manager, a developer, and let me read my notes, a requirements position. Just due to workload increase and the need for,
So add position. We're
I pull it more closely towards you. Thank you. Thanks.
That better. Okay. My apologies. It adds positions to help with the workload increase.
Okay.
37 and 38 are related POPs, 37 being the funds we need to publish the voters' pamphlets in the next cycle in absence of a fee bill. 38 assumes passage of Senate Bill 163 and sufficient fees to publish the voters' pamphlet from those fees.
Okay.
39.
39 is a reclassification. We had originally requested for two positions. We have pulled one of those and are requesting for one reclassification to just more properly align the responsibilities of the work with classification, proper classification.
Has that reclass been vetted through the DAS process that is supposed to be standardizing reclassification requests?
As far as the one that we took care of or the one that we're requesting, I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Representative or Senator Johnson, I'm sorry. I'm not a veteran at testifying, so please excuse my fumbling.
Okay, fine.
As far as the one reclass, we originally requested two. We had permanent financing within the agency we used to take care of that reclassification, and that's why we pulled that.
But it has gone through the DAS process.
But it has been through the DAS process, and it's reflected in the PICS reports in the budget. So, yes.
Thank you.
41 is contracting dollars for the audits division. As you'll see, when we get to performance measures, contracting ends up being more expensive than using employees, and so this would reduce our outside contracting dollars in the audits division. And finally, 42 is sort of an interesting thing that deserves a word of explanation. When the audits division had its review by the National Association, and the name escapes me, the National Association of State Auditors came in and did a review. The one concern they had was the independence of our legal counsel, in that we had the same lawyer, the audits division had the same lawyer as the people that we were auditing, and they wondered about the independence of our legal authority given that. There have been fairly extended discussions with the Department of Justice, and we believe we can build safeguards in place to protect the agency. We did make a promise to submit this as part of our budget, but it's really not. We believe we can accomplish this without the money. This is why it's our last priority.
Madam or Mr. Chair, whichever I have at the moment, is the council a CONSEL?
Yes, it is. Sorry.
Okay. Just wanted to be clear. You
that's a lawyer.
A new board of
no, that's a lawyer. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. All right, Mr. McGuire, we are now going to push ahead into your 10% cuts and then do performance measures and leave 15 minutes.
Okay. On the detailed 10% reductions, item one, meaning the thing we want to let go of first, was our last priority, the independent legal counsel. Items two and three, I think, deserve a word of explanation in that they are a portion of our fifth agency priority.
I have to stop you. A recommendation from your National Association of State Auditors suggests that you have a problem in that you don't have independent legal counsel. That seems to me to be a peer review kind of performance measure, for lack of a better word, and it's the first thing you want to throw out of the boat. Help me understand why that would be the first thing that you would offer as a cut.
Madam Chair, there have been extensive discussions with the Department of Justice about building firewalls within the department. There is a great deal of resistance by the Attorney General to allowing state agencies to go hire their own lawyer. And we are close to an agreement with DOJ that we think will solve this without hiring our own lawyer.
And meets the recommendations of a national association.
We believe it will.
Okay, thank you.
They have not yet reviewed what we are proposing because it's not finalized, but we will cross that bridge.
Okay. Representative Smith.
No, I'm sorry.
Retracted. Go ahead.
The next two are pieces of our fifth agency priority. We're not proposing to cut the whole of our fifth agency priority, but through technology advances, we believe that we can eliminate two positions and other dollars in the business registry portion of the corporation division.
Now I have a question.
Representative Smith.
How come that couldn't just all be done online and get rid of more positions? I mean, it's a one-page form.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, this is part of that process, and I think over time, as more people do this online, once the one-stop shop is up and running, we hope to drive more and more people into an online process.
What's the ratio of online versus non-online?
I don't know that off the top of my head, but I can sure get that information to you. I mean, I will tell you that the percentage of online goes up every year, the percentage of paper goes down every year, and we expect over time this trend to continue to be able to shed positions and money over time.
I'd like to flag this for us because I think you could do a lot more online with that and then take your savings and put them into auditors.
I will ask that the professional staff flag that. The other question I guess I'd ask is, why would this be offered up on a cut list? Why haven't you just done it in the name of agency efficiency and savings?
Madam Chair, this was something that was identified when we were asked to put together a cut list. I went to my directors and said, we need to cut 10%. What can you do? This is when it happens.
That's fine. Okay.
The number that I guess they're, well, the numbering's a little odd here, but because we're using the other priority list, the next two, corporation data processing, are would slow down implementation of IT projects. We're not.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ibaki.
You just said something I found very interesting. I was figuring the numbers just corresponded to something. I don't know what, but these are listed in the order that you would have us make the cuts, I would assume.
Correct.
But the numbers list the way that you suggested that they be made at some other time, in some other list?
My understanding of our instruction was to use these priority numbers relate to the priority numbers from the last exercise.
LFO staff might be able to provide clarification.
Representative Avakian, these are not the numbers from another reduction list. These are the numbers from the prioritization.
Right.
So I'm not sure if your question is, you know, why is a priority 5 above a priority 18?
No.
I think that they just, oh, okay. You're just wondering where the numbers came from.
No,
all right.
I understand.
Okay. Please continue.
35 is the POP for information technology, the central business registry work. One is the is a small piece of the audits division financial reporting work. 41 is another piece is the prior agency priority 41. Which is the contracting dollars in the audits division. 34, the next one, legislatively requested audits that we talked about before. 36, the ISD positions that were POP 173. 32, fraud investigations that we talked about. 37, the voters pamphlet. And because we were required to cut within each fund category, The final one is a reduction in federal funds. Our only source of federal funds is in the Help America Vote Act implementation.
Senator Morse.
Question. I'm troubled by your last statement that you were required to cut within each category as opposed to prioritizing broadly across all of activities. And is that what has been happening?
Chair and Senator Morris, yes, it is. The 10% reduction is by each fund type. And in many agencies, it may not make sense at all, but we've asked that they provide that, because in some agencies there would be some fungibility between fund sources. You could cut these federal funds and potentially use a different source, or cut another fund and move to a federal fund.
However, in consultation with the co-chairs, I think that there would be a lot of latitude to go in phase two and look at these proposed cuts that are like veneer and see if there are any complete programs that agencies would be willing to offer up as a cut instead of just the thin layers across programs. And so this will be something that I think we visit in greater detail as we move through the process described by the co-chairs. Representative Smith.
Thank you. I'm struggling with one or two issues. Back on business support, ISD business support, number 13, it talks about development of a business plan, business process analysis, and improvement in business transition management. I'm struggling with why that one received, knowing how important it is to have to maintain the audits functions of the Secretary of State, why that wouldn't receive some kind of consideration for reduction. I'm trying to figure
out
how
that's... Sorry, I lost my place.
Number 13. Number 13. Priority 13.
Back on the priorities list.
Oh, back on the
priorities list.
I'm just curious what the rationale would be to hold tight to that. How did that stay out of the fray?
In terms of the post cut?
Yeah. How come that didn't get any consideration?
I need to talk to the director of the Information Systems Division. I look to the division directors to propose cuts within their divisions, and so I don't have an answer for that, but I will get an answer for that.
My two cents are sharp enough, because I sure like that central business registry a lot better than I do this one. But that's my two cents, and it's obviously the call of the chair. She takes us.
Performance measure.
Before you go on, what if any of the reductions are from the agency's base budget? They seem to be reductions from policy action packages, or am I not reading this correctly?
Madam Chair, the anomalous situation with our budget is that the governor's recommended budget included all of our POPs, because our POPs, our POPs represented a net reduction in general fund dollars, because it included a POP that refinances the way the Archives Division is funded, amounting to about a $3 million reduction in the general fund. Traditionally, governor's recommended budgets have taken our base budget and a percentage reduction, an unspecified percentage reduction. This is the first time in my knowledge that the governor has said, okay, you get all your POPs, and I presume that that was because our POPs represented a net reduction.
Okay. LFO staff.
And along that line, Chair and members of the subcommittee, I believe the governor's position was that with statewide elected officials, they simply don't make comments either way on policy packages proposed by the separately elected official. A complication that I believe that this committee will be working through in phase two is several of the packages rely on funding from other state agencies or other funding sources. While the governor chose to just pass these packages forward, the corresponding funding was not addressed in the governor's budget either. So K-12 audits, state school fund, did not compensate for the $1.3 million in original package, nor the revised $500,000. Many of the assessment packages for audits division expansion, not there in other agencies' budgets. Archives fund shift, limitation is in archives budget, funding from state agencies, not in state agency packages. So we will have to sort through what policies the subcommittee wants to move forward with and try to identify the corresponding funding in the appropriate agencies to fund those if you want to move forward.
And we do, and that's going to add a complication as we move into phase two, and I'm going to ask the professional staff to revisit that again for the committee's benefit as we move into the work of phase two. Okay, given the shortness of the time, I'm going to ask you to move into performance measures.
The first two pages are the sort of the what we do, agency overview, how we approach this process, and with your indulgence, I'll just dive into the individual performance measures. The first one is for the audits division, and the measure here is the difference in the cost for what an hour of auditing time by state auditors versus for contracted auditing time. We do not, there is a consistent pattern of about a two-thirds relationship in our internal cost of an auditor and the external cost of contracting an audit, and this reflects that fact.
Does it also, Mr. McGuire, include the cost of internal support divisions?
I know that those numbers have been described to me as fully loaded. Whether they are that fully loaded, I'm not certain, and we'll find out.
Okay. In order for this measure to be meaningful, that's a threshold question, in my opinion. Okay.
Okay.
They are on Appendix D, one of the handouts that we gave yesterday.
The next performance measure, also for the audits division, is the amount of cost savings identified by performance audits. The sort of anomalous number there from the 97-99 biennium was a huge finding related to construction, corrections department construction contracting, which was $65 million or something like that, which gives you that quite massive spike in 97-99. We don't expect to find this. And this is sort of a troubling measure for me in that, you know, I'd certainly like to see a day where this was zero, and sort of looking, you know, wanting to find more waste seems like a kind of an odd measure, but we've struggled with these sorts of things in all sorts of ways.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Obama.
This represents amount identified, not amount implemented by the agency based on what you found.
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, yes. And since we don't have control over what the agencies do, but you do.
Yes, again.
But I think Representative Avakian has hit on something very interesting, and that's the follow-through. I mean, somehow it seems to me that if there's not a way to track the actual savings achieved, that we've kind of missed the mark on the measure. Am I putting words in your mouth, Representative?
Well, maybe just a little bit, because I think I agree with the Secretary that their function is to make the identification and that the implementation lies somewhere else. And so maybe a performance measure within the agency or somewhere else should identify whether this was implemented.
Madam Chair, if we can hold on this discussion for two more measures, I think we'll get there.
Okay. Soldier on, Mr. McGuire.
The next measure is dollar savings per dollar spent on economy and efficiency audits. The economy and efficiency audits are a subset of performance audits generally, and so this number does differ from the oft-quoted $8 for $1. This is an even better return than that.
Okay.
The next measure is, I think, what Representative Avakian was getting at, and this is percentage of recommendations implemented. This is something that we have just started to measure, and so there is no historical information, though we're going to try and go back and build some data here. And but this is a little bit, I mean, I have wrestled with how to measure that. I mean, all recommendations are not created equal. And you know, it is a $10 million recommendation equal to a recommendation about a control of a policy control or spending control. And I mean, this is something we need to think about quite a bit. There is some work going on nationally on this that our audits division has been involved in, and it is our intent over time to split this one measure into four categories, separating out information technology, financial management, investigations, and municipal audits, so that we have four separate numbers. We don't have that yet.
Representative Avakian.
Okay, this is where I think we're getting to with this issue, because you obviously have a process after you identify something to go back later and see whether it was implemented. But you're not an enforcement arm. But should your auditing have an enforcement mechanism, or is it purely not within your department, but should it have an enforcement mechanism, or is it purely informational? You understand? Is my question clear?
My view is that the Secretary of State is the auditor. The Secretary of State is not the manager, the overseer of the entire executive department. So it seems to me that we feel we have succeeded when we work with agencies and they use our audits as a roadmap. But I don't think it would be appropriate to give the Secretary of State the authority to direct agencies to do specific things.
Which is not what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, should your audit be perceived as something that should be enforced by somebody else, not by you? Or is it to be perceived purely as informational to take or not, as somebody wishes?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, I mean, it is certainly our hope, our goal in doing these is that they are recommendations that will be implemented. I mean, we're not just doing this to give people interesting information. And so that's our goal when we write an audit, is to do it in a manner that's useful to the agency, and that's why there's a lot of interaction with the agency as that process goes on. And that it is realistic in terms of what they can do with the resources that they have.
It would be interesting, Madam Chair, if we had, if there was some type of an Attorney General's opinion, a legal opinion on what the effect of your audit is to be. I don't know if that exists anywhere, but I don't know if there's a common understanding about that.
Ms. Brown has just jotted that down, and we can do a little research for the benefit of the committee. Senator Morrison, Representative Smith.
If you'll indulge an editorial comment, if corporate America was structured lines of authority as exists within the state of Oregon government, it would not be very efficient. It wouldn't. I mean, we are structurally, the way we function, we're just structurally inefficient. Because here you have the Secretary of State performing audits, making recommendations with no lines of authority, and it's a bully pulpit, essentially, that you have to raise an issue in the political spectrum, in the public eye, that will force, hopefully, someone to make a change. Now, if corporate America operated that way, it wouldn't be very efficient. So, excuse me.
Thank you, Senator Morris. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Here's where I get the audit on me. Do you folks have an internal auditor that audits what you folks do internally?
No, we do not. We are subject to regular review by external auditors. We contract out to have external auditors come in and look at our activity. We do not have an internal auditor per se.
You contract out for the auditor.
Correct.
I can't resist, Madam.
Representative Mavaki.
Thank you for indulging. Since we're creating a record, an editorial comment in response, I think there's an important difference why we don't function like corporate America, which you have a board of directors or a president that is, in essence, a dictator. It's not a democratic process. We have a form of checks and balances in order to, which is not as efficient, but which for principle exists for a reason, which maybe is for a better discussion later.
History 101 here.
Thank you. We have 10 minutes remaining. Mr. McGuire, please continue. Representative Smith,
well,
you have a question?
I just want to follow up on you folks provide oversight over the legislature in terms of ensuring acceptable submittal of contribution expenditure reports.
Elections.
We have the government standards folks who oversee us. I assume also oversee you folks. Who looks internally at what you're doing? These auditors that you contract. Would it make sense to have that contracting authority moved out and have it?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't think so. I mean, it is very clear in the contract that this is to be an independent review. You know, we bid this out. This is not some sweetheart deal with.
I'm not implying that.
But
I'm bringing credibility. I'm chair of a campaign finance reform committee, and part of our job is to bring credibility, and we want to work with the Secretary of State office. I'm curious if, as we're looking at tightening up with the legislature, perceives as issues, if this was one that you folks, it's one of those things that you'd be able to say, we don't even audit ourselves, someone else does it, and handles even the contracting of that.
I feel comfortable, Representative Smith, in saying that we don't audit ourselves. We contract that out to independent auditors who take a hard look.
And I'm not disagreeing. I'm just raising the issue.
And it's my understanding that that meets government accounting standards, and that's the way this is done.
Okay, continue.
We're now done with the audits division, onto the archives division, and I will confess we spent a lot of time trying to come up with effective performance measures here. It is hard for me, for example, to come up with a good performance measure for administrative rule publication. And so we have no,
Madam Chair, related to performance measures.
Representative Mavaki.
Thank you. I just very coincidentally was at the archives building recently reading with the archivist, Mr. Turnbaugh, and one of the things they are trying to do is figure out how they can interact more with the public because of all the valuable things that they have there. And they're setting up projects periodically to do that. And I just wonder if a lost performance measure is our better way to use the archives division with some type of public contact. Because I think that the number of visitors that go to the archives building, the number of projects that they set up, they have FTE devoted to that, might be something of value to you.
Thank you. We'll take a look at that. Moving on?
Yes, please.
We have
now 3 minutes.
The next performance measure relates to what we talked about with Representative Smith before. This is the number of agencies cooperating in the one-stop business registry. The next series of slides relates to processing time for documents filed in the corporation division, the turnaround time. It's worth noting, I think, that in the state of California, if you want your any business forms processed within 5 days, you have to pay a $500 additional express fee. We routinely, these are these are hours, not counting weekends. So this isn't just work hours. This is, 48 hours means 2 days, not counting weekends. So the next here, there are three, I guess, related to processing time. The next is a customer service measure that this is surveying our customers who interact with external customers who interact with the corporation division. Moving on, the next is a look at the cost of the voter's pamphlet by page. This is the cost of the voter's pamphlet divided by the number of pages times the number that we mail out.
This one is absolutely mystifying to me. Why the cost per page is 50% greater for the 04, and you have
there's
an answer.
There's an easy explanation for that. There is
ahead.
A very easy explanation for that. The last three general elections, we have published two-volume voters' pamphlets, a statewide measure book that is exactly the same sent to every Oregonian, and then 30 candidate books. The cost of production of 30 candidate books is significantly higher than the one measure book. The primary voters' pamphlets are all the 30 separate books. So the per unit cost goes down in the general election because you have this bulk mailing of 1.9 million identical books.
With that, I am going to stop us. We're at a point where we're racing and I think not doing particularly good work. And so I would like to simply acknowledge that we're off the schedule now and that when you come back for phase two, I'd like to spend a little more time looking at these performance measures.
That would be very
and the
valuable.
Overarching question, I guess, that I have is since many of these measures are new and developed only within the scope of this budget process, what have the internal measures that you've been using heretofore been to ensure that you're serving Oregonians and operating efficiently? And I guess that will be the question that I'll ask when we come back and begin again, just if you can nuance any of these. By way of conclusion, Representative Smith.
Well, I wanted to feed in on that. I have to truly compliment you folks on your corporate division. It is very, very well done. From the way you folks handle uniform commercial code filings and their public display, to the way you process assumed business names, to even the notary public in your business information center. Job well done.
Good. On that high note, then, I'm going to move into a few administrative things. The first thing that I think would be very helpful for all of us is if you would give the professional staff to disseminate to the committee the scope that Ms. Polino has developed for the K-12 audits. I think that will inform our discussion in the next section. The next thing is for our visitors today, I have brought for you as gifts from the committee, and these were purchased at no public cost, blue books. These are so hot off the press that I have been instructed by the staff to tell you that this is for your young man.
Mr. Secretary, would you mind signing?
I was just going to get to that. I have marked
Karen,
the secretary
I'm
picture.
The oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting.
Can we chop liver?
And what we'll ask the secretary to do, you'll see in the review of the blue books that these books have the pictures of the statewide elected officers and the legislature and all the judges. As you proceed through today and you have the opportunity to meet some of your elected officials and representatives, you might ask them to sign these. And I hope that this will be a nice memento of your day here in the legislature and will continue your interest in the legislative process.
And I would say you'll get envious glances because these are just now available today, and so.
So you guys are getting the first one, and I actually had to bludgeon those out of the secretary's staff, and they were quite cooperative because this panel is hearing his budget.
And you bring these by to me, I'll tell you which signatures you don't want.
That's the reason that you all have those. The next thing is I want to discuss the process for next week a little bit. I think that all of us that are in Ways and Means have been struggling with how to approach the prioritization. And I will share with you a very instructive session that Representative Smith and I had with respect to the portfolio of budgets in his economic and transportation and economic development subcommittee. And I would like to recommend this for your consideration. We went through the budgets with the prioritization listed with the professional staff. And then last night, I actually did this, and this is when it came to me that it's achievable. Going through the prioritization with the material that you're provided and having the opportunity to see high, medium, or low, if we as a panel agree with the prioritization. Is this a high priority of the agency, a medium priority, or a low priority? Then hopefully, and I've asked the professional staff to distribute to each one of you today all of the budgets that are in the portfolio of the General Government Subcommittee. I will ask you over the weekend to go through this exercise and come prepared on Monday. There will also be a calendar attached. Come prepared on Monday to begin the debate among the panel on whether or not we agree. I have transportation in my hands, which is not one of the budgets that we're doing, but the first page, I agreed with the agency in my evaluation that their first listings were all high priorities. I would expect the process in this committee, if you all agree, we'll all bring our sheets of the work we've done over the weekend. We'll sit here and go down, and on those that we can agree on, we're in agreement, and we move on. On those that there's debate, where let's assume Representative Krupp decides something is a low priority, all the rest of us have it as a high, we would engage then in the committee process to tease out why it is that some of us thought it was high, some of us thought it was low. We may change minds, we may not. But that way we can arrive at a consensus process to say that we either agree with the agency's prioritizations or we don't. And that will help instruct how we proceed. In some cases, when I went through transportation last night, I discovered that I needed more information from the professional staff, and they would be sitting with us to help inform the discussion. And this way, without paying any attention to the money attached to it, we're just looking at the activity and seeing whether or not we are in general concurrence with the prioritization activities as described by the agency. I would welcome any ideas that any of you would have that might be a better or more streamlined process. I can tell you I went through all the budgets in Representative Smith's committee last night. It took a number of hours to do it, but at the end I felt that I had a fairly good internal understanding of why the agency had done what they did. We had several other ways that we could have proceeded. I discussed with the professional staff, should I bring in a chair's version and ask you all to react to it? I don't think that's fair to the committee process. I would much rather engage you all, if you agree, in the kind of individual prioritization, and then we come back and have the collegial exchange to see whether or not we're in generalized agreement, and then we can send forward our prioritizations to the co-chairs. Representative Ivakian.
I think it sounds like a fine process. How would you like us to either add or detract from the list that was given to us by the agency?
What I've done, and I'm not asking you to mirror my process, but I'm just telling you it worked fairly well last night. Excuse me. As I went through and prioritized them, I wrote little notes. You know, why is this in here? And I would expect that that would be part of the debate that we as colleagues would engage in at the committee level and then report that back out to the co-chairs. If it turns out that we can either convince each other that the prioritization ought to move or that an activity is inappropriate as it's listed by the agency, fine. If we can't, we would probably go to higher arbiters, and that would be the co-chairs and the vice co-chairs. But actually sitting down and soldiering through it proved to be instructive, and I think that it invites the full participation of the committee rather than starting with a chair and staff version. I would much rather invite the participation of the whole committee, and we see where we are as we move through the week of prioritization. By everybody's admission, we have a very rigorous process that we have to go through next week, and so I would ask all of you to do the homework. You will be getting in your offices all of the budgets relevant to this committee, a schedule, a memorandum from me reiterating this process, and a plea at the end that we all come prepared on Monday to begin in accordance with the calendar that is being distributed in the packets.
When, Madam Chair, when will the packets?
Sometime today at the latest tomorrow morning, because it is, I didn't go to the professional staff with this recommendation until 8:30 this morning, and it's going to be somewhat burdensome for them to just get all the material gathered up. And it'll mean that some of your weekend is engaged with sitting down, pouring through these budgets in a considerable level of detail. And in many cases, at least this was my own personal finding in doing this, I hadn't asked sufficiently probative questions during the committee hearing. I hadn't paid enough attention. I had questions that I couldn't answer absent input from the staff, and I just flagged those with question marks and said that we would come back and, as part of our committee process, re-inform me so that I could make a judicious evaluation of whether or not it was a high, medium, or low priority.
Would it be possible, Madam Chair, to have a screen put up with three columns of a high, medium, and low, so that way as we go through each budget and we come to consensus, we can have the high column, put, you know, whatever it is in that column, the mediums, and that way we can keep track of...
I'm perfectly willing to make whatever accommodation helps folks come to agreement on this. Some are visual,
I'm a visual person.
So I will ask that accommodation be made, and we can end up with a written record of the deliberations.
Just use an overhead.
Yeah,
that's just my thought.
On the whiteboard, or just however we do it. It sounds weirder than it is to actually sit down and do it. I found myself in generalized, again, I have ODOTs in my hand, I found myself in generalized agreement with the agency. There were some things that appeared to have some overlap, and I thought that it would profit from the debate among colleagues and with the professional staff to help fine-tune my opinion about whether or not I was in agreement with the agency that was a high, low, or a medium priority. So if there's consensus, that's how we'll proceed.
Excellent.
Just one more question. At some point during phase two, do we then go through a process of comparing each agency to the other as opposed to an internal ordering of priorities?
I will raise that nuanced question with the co-chairs because I cannot answer it.
And I tried to not be so nuanced. I thought it was just like right out there.
But what context are you talking about in terms of comparison?
Well, we're...
Are you talking about dollars? Are you talking about prioritization?
One leads to the other in my mind.
Okay.
One would... You start with the prioritization and then lead to a discussion of dollars.
I also would commend your question to the full Ways and Means tomorrow, where we will have 2 hours to review with the co-chairs and the vice co-chairs exactly what their instructions are. I have not reviewed with them the instructions that I've just shared with you all. I believe it to be consistent with where they're heading, and I know that it was a process that worked well for me last night. But I think tomorrow's meeting will be pivotal in bringing a deeper level of understanding to all of us about what the co-chair's expectations are.
In the sub that the four of us serve on, the one thing I'm going to try and do in a little bit in addition to this is I want to break it out by the categories. Because you take the ODOT budget, it is a monster budget, and there's different elements. You have a DMV element, you have this, you have that, and I want to break those out into high, medium, or low within the categories.
Good. Well, we can continue that discussion tomorrow. So without objection, I am going to close the public hearing on the Secretary of State's budget. With apologies to Mr. McGuire that we did not have time to hear his stirring rendition of Danny Boy, but I'm sure he